Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something. Well, it's a kind of profound intellectual and spiritual archaeology.
That's a great way to put it.
We are taking the decades of research from Dolores Cannon, all those thousands of hypnotic regressions, her quantum healing hypnosis technique, or QHHT, and we're placing it right alongside millennia of ancient Indian cosmology.
Specifically, we're looking at the foundational tenets of Hinduism and Buddhist philosophy.
And the result of this juxtaposition is, frankly, astonishing.
It really is. What we found is a modern metaphysical system that seems to, on one hand, validate the entire core architecture of these ancient traditions. It confirms things like rebirth, karma, the eternal nature of the soul.
But then, and this is the twist, it simultaneously claims that the traditional paths to liberation, the very goals of those ancient systems developed over thousands of years, are now, for many people, obsolete.
Obsolete. Superseded. No longer necessary. It's a huge claim.
Okay, so let's unpack this and get straight to our mission for this deep dive. The source material is a very detailed comparative study. Our goal here is to assess what this comparison really tells us about Dolores Cannon's legacy.
Right. Is she just a spiritual traditionalist who found a new tool, hypnosis, to confirm old truths that have been around forever?
Or was she something else entirely? Was she, as her followers would suggest, a kind of metaphysical reporter, you know, chronicling a genuinely radical, evolving cosmology that completely changes the game for human spiritual development?
And the answer we found is that she was kind of both. Initially, she absolutely functioned as a psychic investigator. She was gathering experiential, anecdotal evidence for these huge frameworks that, for centuries, people only accepted through faith or, you know, deep philosophical study.
Things like karma, the mechanics of the soul. She was putting case files to the theory.
Exactly. But then, at a certain point, her reporting pivoted. It took a sharp turn, and she started documenting that these traditional, incredibly arduous paths, like Hindu moksha or Buddhist nibbana, are being fast-tracked or even completely superseded by a new cosmic plan.
So she confirmed the ancient structure.
And then documented its radical present-day renovation.
That structural renovation is the absolute core of what we're looking at.
Mm.
So let's start where she and the ancient traditions find common ground. We have to build that shared architecture first to really feel the impact of the contradiction later on.
Let's do it.
So part one, the validation of the core cosmological architecture.
The essential starting point, the absolute bedrock for any profound philosophical tradition coming out of India is Sahasrara. It's the backdrop to everything.
And we're not just talking about reincarnation in a simple, you know, I was a queen in a past life kind of way.
No, not at all. This is the perpetual cyclical existence of all beings spinning across infinite time and space. It's a cosmic principle.
And it's so crucial to remember that within these ancient philosophies, Sahasrara is fundamentally characterized by dukkha.
Mm.
We often translate dukkha just as suffering, but that's really reductive, isn't it? Philosophically, it means something much deeper, like a profound existential unsatisfactoriness.
Precisely. To really get the traditional perspective, you have to understand the three types of suffering that the sources reference. First, there's dukkha-dukkha. That's the simple, obvious stuff, the suffering of pain, injury, old age, grief. It's what we all recognize as suffering.
The easy one to spot.
Right. But then there's viparinamadukkha, which is the suffering of change. This is more subtle. It's the knowledge that even our happiness is impermanent. That wonderful feeling you have will inevitably decay and disappear, and the clinging to it is itself a form of suffering.
Because you know it won't last.
Exactly. But the deepest type, the one that really gets to the core of it, is Sakkara Dukkha. This is the suffering of conditioned existence itself.
Okay, break that down.
It's the understanding that everything, and I mean everything, in Sahasrara is composite. It's patched together. It's unstable. And it's therefore inherently incapable of providing any ultimate lasting peace or satisfaction. The very fabric of reality is flawed.
So the traditional goal isn't just to fix your painful life or to get a better rebirth next time. The goal is to escape the wheel itself. Because the wheel, even the good parts, is structurally broken.
Absolutely. The whole system is the problem.
Yeah.
And this is precisely where Dolores Cannon begins her validation. Her entire QHHT methodology is built on the absolute presupposition of Sahasrara.
The fact that you can regress someone to a past life means there was a past life.
It's the operating premise. She affirms that the self, or the soul, exists across these vast, complex, nonlinear realities. The individual you are today is just one expression in a very long, ongoing story. You are the cumulative effect of that entire cyclical process.
So the very act of regressing a client beyond this lifetime implies that this continuous cycle of samsara is the underlying reality. If the soul just extinguished at death, the whole technique would be impossible. There'd be nowhere to go.
It moves the entire concept of rebirth from the realm of, you know, esoteric theory or something you take on faith into an observable, repeatable, though we should say admittedly anecdotal, field of research.
She created a methodology to explore it.
Yes. Cannon's work is a deep investigation into the mechanics and the incredible complexity of this metaphysical world. She's confirming that the self continuously cycles through lifetimes to gather experience. The common ground is the cycle itself.
But the experience of that cycle is where the first difference appears.
It is. In the ancient traditions, it's a terrifying trap you want to escape. In Cannon's system, it's a massive cosmic university curriculum that you signed up for.
Okay, so if Sarsa is the wheel we're all stuck on, then karma has to be the engine that keeps that wheel spinning.
That's the perfect analogy. Traditionally, karma means action, specifically intentional actions of your body, your speech, and your mind. These actions generate unseen consequences. In Sanskrit, they're called phala or vipaka.
And those consequences are what chain you to the next life and the next.
Exactly. And it's an impersonal natural law. It's like gravity. It doesn't care if you're a good person or a bad person. It just operates. You do the action, you get the result.
And traditionally, this law is totally inexorable, right? You generate a debt, and that consequence absolutely must be played out, even if it takes multiple lifetimes.
It has to be balanced, which is why the traditional path demands such intense discipline. We're talking about, you know, millennia-long moral practices, complex rituals, deep, sustained meditative insight. All of it is designed to slowly, painstakingly burn away those karmic debts and purify what they call the mind stream.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. And this is where the modernization happens in Cannon's work. And it's, from a therapeutic perspective, truly ingenious. She validates the reality of karmic debt, 100%.
But instead of demanding a lifetime of purification,
she turns it into a modern, solvable problem.
That's the critical pivot our sources point to. Cannon's primary therapeutic goal was to regress her clients to the appropriate past life, the one where the originating negative karma, the root cause, occurred.
So if a client came in with a chronic illness or a very specific intense phobia or maybe the same disastrous relationship pattern over and over,
she would track it back. The cause was located in a specific, often very traumatic, intentional action from a previous incarnation.
Right. But here's the big question. Why is the mere act of remembering enough to fix it? If karma is this impersonal law like gravity, shouldn't you still have to suffer the consequence, even if you know why?
That's the genius of the modernization.
Sure.
Cannon's system presupposes that your subconscious mind, which she calls the higher self, already knows the connection. It's the conscious mind, the active ego running your daily life, that is blocked from that knowledge. The moment the client, while in that deep theta state of hypnosis, sees the originating trauma and intellectually understands her own role in creating the consequence, that is what she called the conscious cognitive breakthrough.
So the energy of the karmic lesson is actually attached to the ignorance of the cause.
Precisely. It's not about some external repayment. It's about internal integration. Yeah. The suffering continues only until the lesson is finally learned. And the moment the conscious mind connects the dots, the need for that external karmic consequence to keep manifesting as suffering, it just dissolves.
The job is done. The lesson is delivered.
Exactly. Our sources describe it as secularizing and modernizing a profound theological concept. Karma is no longer this cosmic debt collector demanding painful sacrifice.
It's more like a computer bug.
Yes. The file corruption, your present-day issue, is fixed the moment your conscious mind gets access to the corrupted source file from a past life and finally integrates the lesson. By understanding the source of the trauma, the client can resolve the current issue.
And her case studies are full of these reports of immediate physical or psychological healing.
It's a remarkable fast-track mechanism. It affirms the law of cause and effect, but then provides this radical shortcut to resolution, completely bypassing the need for decades of moral struggle or penance.
Okay, so moving beyond the mechanism of time and consequence, let's talk about the scope of existence, the playing field.
The different realms.
Right. Traditional Indian cosmology is filled with multiple realms of rebirth. Buddhist texts, for example, detail 6 main realms. These range from the heavens of the gods and demigods, down through the human and animal realms, and into the suffering states of hungry ghosts and hell beings.
And these all represent the different kinds of metaphysical states you can be reborn into based on the kind of karma you've accumulated. Good karma gets you a heavenly vacation. Bad karma, Not so much.
Exactly. And Cannon's subjects, during their regressions, absolutely confirmed that the field of potential experience extends far, far beyond just these Earth-based realms.
It wasn't just six options.
Not even close. It was exponential. Cannon's subjects provided this stream of contemporary, very detailed anecdotal evidence. They accessed lives and experiences across what she termed different dimensions and planetary systems.
This is a critical expansion of the traditional map.
A huge one. Instead of, you know, six distinct realms all sort of revolving around our terrestrial existence, Cannon's work affirms a multidimensional cosmos that is just teeming with potential incarnations.
Can you give us a sense of the specifics? What kind of non-linear realities were these people reporting? Was it just like descriptions of other planets with other humans on them?
Oh, far from it. The sources detail regressions where subjects access non-corporeal existences, lives as beings of pure energy or light, incarnations on what they describe as higher vibrational, non-physical planets that were basically just schools for consciousness.
Wow.
And these subjects would often report feeling profoundly alien back in their human bodies. They couldn't process the dense, heavy, slow nature of Earth's vibration after remembering these other existences.
So this really positions Cannon's work as a kind of cosmological update. She affirmed the ancient idea of multiple realms of existence, but then she documented its scale as being far beyond the confines of Earth-centric mythology.
She pushed the concept from terrestrial metaphysics into full-blown universal cosmology.
It seems like she validated the concept of variety within Saisora while dramatically broadening the definition of what even constitutes a lifetime.
Yes. It confirms the ancient framework, but then uses these modern channeling techniques to fill in the rest of the galactic map.
It feels like she provided modern experiential proof for the first half of the traditional formula. Saisora is real, karma is real, and the universe is vast and full of possibilities.
That is the perfect segue, because having established this incredible shared cosmology, we now hit the fundamental philosophical chasm.
The breaking point.
The breaking point. It's all about the nature of the entity that is cycling through all those lives. And this is where Cannon's findings align perfectly with Hinduism, but create a direct, irreconcilable contradiction with Buddhism.
Right, part two. The fundamental philosophical split. Soul versus no self. Let's start with the alignment with Hinduism. Cannon's research is, it's unequivocally soul-affirming. What did her subjects consistently report about the nature of the self?
They reported, over and over again, that the individual you see walking around, the personality, the ego, the person listening to this right now, is merely a fragment or an aspect of a much larger permanent entity.
The whole soul or oversoul.
That's her terminology. She often describes these fragments as splinters or shards of the whole soul that are deliberately sent out into incarnation to gather knowledge and experience.
And why is that necessary? Why can't the whole soul just incarnate?
Because the essential permanent entity is described as being too vast, too powerful, too high frequency to be contained fully within a dense physical body. It has to send out a smaller piece of itself to have the experience.
And this sounds exactly like the core doctrine of the Upanishads, the foundational texts of Hindu philosophy.
It's an almost flawless experiential match. This aligns perfectly with the Hindi doctrine of Atman, the permanent, unchanging spiritual essence within every single being, and its relationship with Brahman, which is the ultimate, unchanging, universal reality.
The ocean and the drop.
The ocean and the drop. And the entire purpose of the Hindu path, the path that leads to liberation or Moksha, is the realization of this core identity, that your individual, eternal Atman is, and always has been, one with the universal Brahman.
So in a way, Dolores Cannon used modern hypnotic techniques to gather thousands of personal testimonials that experientially confirmed the Hindu philosophical definition of the soul.
Yes. She provided modern data points for an ancient spiritual truth. For anyone following a Hindu philosophical path or a similar soul-affirming tradition, Cannon's work serves as this massive modern validation. It provides evidence that the soul is real, it's eternal, and it's intrinsically connected to the divine source.
The confirmation of the self as a permanent entity is the cornerstone of her entire system.
It is. Now, hold that thought about the eternal soul, because it requires us to pivot sharply to its direct philosophical opposition.
The core Buddhist doctrine of anatta, or non-self.
Exactly. And this is what fundamentally distinguishes Buddhism from most soul-affirming schools of Hinduism. It's the central point of departure.
And anatta isn't just a minor disagreement. It's a categorical, foundational denial of any permanent, unchanging, independent soul or spiritual essence. It says there is no enduring Atman.
And this denial is absolutely crucial because a belief in a substantial, permanent self, an illusion they call moha, is seen in Buddhism as the absolute root cause of all suffering.
The root of the whole problem.
The very root. If you believe in a permanent I, you will spend your entire existence trying to protect that I, satisfy its desires, and solidify its existence. This generates attachment, or tana, and those attachments are the fuel that keeps the wheel of samsara spinning.
So the path to liberation isn't about finding your permanent true self.
It's about realizing, with profound insight, that the permanent self you've been chasing never existed in the first place.
Okay, but if there's no permanent self, what is the individual? What is it that's being reborn?
That is the classic question. The individual is understood instead as a dynamic, continuous, but ultimately impermanent composite of five processes. These are the standas, or the five aggregates.
Form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness.
Right. And these are not entities. They are continuously arising and passing phenomena. Think of the famous analogy of the chariot from the old texts.
If you take away the wheels, the axle, the body, the shaft.
There is no permanent chariot remaining as a separate thing. Chariot is merely the name we give to the temporary assembly of those parts.
So our consciousness, our personality, is just the temporary assembly of these five skandhas. It's a process, not an entity.
Exactly. There is a continuity of effect. The texts describe it like one candle flame lighting the next. The flame is continuous, but it's not the same flame from moment to moment. But the entity itself, the self, is fundamentally empty of any inherent independent existence. The technical term is shunyata.
Which means that because Canon's work so strongly affirms the existence of the whole soul, this permanent, eternal entity-gathering experience.
It implicitly rejects the necessity of the entire Buddhist path, which is built on realizing the three marks of existence. Impermanence, anicca, suffering, dukkha, and non-self, anatta.
So the most fundamental philosophical truth in Dolores Cannon's system is considered the primary and most destructive illusion in Buddhism.
Yes. How's that for a contradiction?
How do the sources handle the weight of that?
They just state it clearly. Cannon's work and the core philosophical path of early Buddhism are, on this central point of identity, irreconcilable. If the soul is eternal, then anna is a false doctrine, and the Buddhist framework for eliminating suffering by eliminating the illusory self is, well, redundant.
It's a solution to a problem that in her system doesn't exist.
Correct. Her work validates the architecture of samsara, but completely negates the philosophical mechanism for escape that was proposed by the Buddha.
Wow. Okay, let's go back to karma then. Because if you view it through this new lens, through the lens of an eternal soul that's here to learn, the whole concept has to shift.
It does. It shifts from being an impersonal cosmic law to a highly personalized educational tool.
In traditional Buddhism, as we said, karma is inexorable. It's a universal, impersonal law that perpetuates samsara for all unenlightened beings equally. You create the cause, you experience the effect, it's a debt that must be paid.
But in canon system, the sources report that karma is much more, well, forgiving and strategic.
How so?
It's entirely reframed. It becomes a chosen curriculum. It's a set of lessons that a soul deliberately decides it wants to learn before it even incarnates.
So it's pre-incarnation planning. You sit down with your oversoul and map out your next life.
Essentially, yes. And crucially, the suffering you experience isn't just cosmic debt collection. It's the agreed-upon resistance that is necessary for your spiritual growth. The soul knows what challenges it needs to overcome to evolve.
That sounds far less terrifying than the traditional view. It transforms this sense of inevitable punishment into a chosen assignment.
And that leads directly to the system's most empowering claim, the power of your conscious thought. Reality in Canon's system is governed by a combination of that pre-incarnation planning and the creative power of your conscious thought right now.
So life circumstances aren't just inflicted upon you. They're often part of a soul's chosen plan. But your present state of belief dictates how that plan actually manifests.
Exactly. I remember that quote from the sources. One of her channeled entities says, "The acceptance of the possibility creates that open door which allows that possibility to enter."
That puts an enormous amount of responsibility and power on the individual's present mental state.
It does. It suggests that if you can change your conscious belief about a past karmic debt, for example, by accepting that you have paid it or that the lesson has been learned, you can literally begin to dissolve the debt itself.
That's a profound contrast with traditional karmic law. That law dictates that consequences manifest regardless of whether you consciously understand the intention that set them in motion.
Right. Canon systems suggest your intention and your will, guided by your higher self, can absolutely override what was once seen as a mechanical universal debt.
That reframing is key. It changes the nature of existence from a punishment mechanism to a highly personalized, manageable learning environment.
And this reconceptualization sets the stage for the most radical claim in all of Kanner's work. This is where she stops being just a traditional investigator and steps fully into the role of a chronicler of cosmic evolution.
A shift so profound, it claims to render the traditional paths to liberation obsolete for anyone participating in this change.
Let's get into part three, the radical cosmological shift, or superseding liberation.
Historically, attaining liberation requires intense, grinding discipline. You hear stories of people spending decades in a cave, meditating, cultivating wisdom, self-control, compassion. It's a very effort-based system designed to slowly choke off the roots of samsara.
It is traditionally slow and painful work. But Canon subjects from the later part of her career consistently reported an astonishing phenomenon.
Which was?
That a massive vibrational shift is occurring on Earth right now, a shift leading towards the establishment of what she calls a new Earth. And because of this planetary shift, karma is being virtually canceled for awakened individuals whose own personal vibration has reached a certain level.
Hold on. Virtually canceled. That sounds like spiritual bankruptcy relief. How does that not completely undermine the entire idea of moral accountability? If I caused immense suffering in a past life, how can I just ascend out of the debt?
That is the essential challenge this claim raises, and the sources explain that this isn't some random act of benevolence. It's a planned planetary intervention.
A cosmic plan.
A cosmic plan. The logic is that the planet itself is ascending to the next dimension. And that means the dense, a low-frequency framework that required painful, slow karmic debt repayment is dissolving. It's becoming obsolete.
Oh, okay.
So for souls who have reached the necessary vibrational threshold, those who have demonstrated mastery of certain emotional and spiritual lessons like forgiveness and compassion, holding on to that old, dense karma is actually counterproductive to the ascension process. It weighs them down.
So the criteria for cancellation isn't necessarily fully repaying every single debt one by one. It's achieving a certain frequency state that makes the old debt irrelevant to the new environment you're moving into.
That's it, exactly. The old, painful system of repayment was designed for the old Earth frequency. The new Earth is said to operate on different rules, where things like instant manifestation and conscious co-creation are the norms. The implication is profound.
Canon is acting as a reporter, a chronicler, documenting the end of the old rules for those who are ready to move forward.
It's the ultimate fast-track liberation program, provided you can align your own frequency with the cosmic upgrade that's happening.
But this puts a massive question mark over thousands of years of traditional spiritual effort. If you spent 40 years in a Himalayan cave meditating to achieve moksha, and someone else gets karmic cancellation by, you know, raising their vibration over a few years, what was the value of the original path?
That is the exact tension the source material explores. It suggests that the traditional path remains perfectly valid for the old Earth structure, for the old game. But for those who are ready for this multidimensional shift, the rules of the game have changed.
It speaks to a cosmic evolution, an acceleration that just wasn't possible or even necessary in previous eras of human history.
And to explain who is receiving this fast-track freedom, Canon introduced a very sophisticated, modern mythological framework.
The three waves of volunteers.
Yes. This framework provides a new and very empowering identity for people who feel fundamentally out of place in modern society.
We mentioned earlier the traditional Mahayana Buddhist bodhisattva ideal, the enlightened being who deliberately delays their own nirvana out of immense compassion to stay in the cycle and help all other beings. That's a path of immense suffering and commitment. How do the volunteers compare to that?
They are drastically different. The bodhisattva is committed to the long, arduous process within the traditional framework of suffering. They work with the old rules. The volunteers, as they're described, are souls from other dimensions, other planets, or other perfected planes of existence.
They're not from here.
They're not from here. They specifically incarnated on Earth to inject high-frequency energy into the dense Earth environment to help facilitate the planetary ascension. They are outside agents.
This is a radical reframing of personal alienation. If you struggle with negativity, if you feel acutely sensitive, if you just don't fit into the norms of society, this framework says that feeling is actually evidence of a noble, otherworldly origin.
That is its immense narrative value. These volunteers are often reported as being brand new to Earth's dense negative vibration. They struggle profoundly with human emotions like anger and sadness because they are not native to that frequency band.
They're not used to it.
And the sources are very clear on this point. They did not come here to resolve millennia of their own personal debt. They explicitly chose to come to Earth without personal karma. Their purpose is purely functional. It's to fulfill a specific collective mission or contract.
So their assignment isn't personal resolution, it's planetary assistance. This provides a profound sense of direct purpose. It moves the individual from being a small, confused person struggling in a chaotic world to being an agent of cosmic intervention.
It's a powerful antidote to modern feelings of nihilism and helplessness.
The volunteer narrative provides immediate meaning. You aren't just a human who found a mission. You are an eternal soul who is the mission. This psychological comfort, this reframing of personal struggle as a noble assignment, is a crucial element in why Cannon's work resonates so deeply with so many people.
And that brings us to the ultimate goal, the final destination. Because the goals of the two systems are fundamentally completely incompatible.
Let's start with the Buddhist goal, Nirvana.
Nirvana literally means extinguishing, like blowing out a candle flame. It is the complete cessation of the cycle of rebirth and suffering. It's the extinguishing of the ego and the selfish desires that fuel conditioned existence.
It is a release from samsara into the unconditioned, the unmanifest. It's a release from all form and all conditions.
It is the ultimate letting go, the end of the story. But the canon goal, the planetary ascension to the new earth, is about the ultimate continuation.
A new chapter.
A whole new book. It is the ultimate optimistic evolution. The goal is not cessation, but collective planetary evolution and ascension into a higher, more refined dimensional state of being.
So it's a continuation of experience, but in a pure, higher frequency form, where consciousness keeps its journey going, just without all the negativity, density, and suffering of the old Earth.
Precisely. So Buddhism is, in a way, philosophically pessimistic about conditioned form. It argues that all compounded things, anything that is put together, must inevitably lead to dukkha. Therefore, the only true and lasting freedom is to extinguish form entirely.
Whereas Cannon's cosmology is deeply optimistic about form and evolution.
Deeply. It says that existence itself is fundamentally benevolent and designed for growth, and that the physical realm is simply transitioning to a purer state of being. The goal isn't to leave the game, it's to advance to the next level of play.
And that's a goal that is inherently more appealing to a modern culture that is so focused on progress, growth, and continuation.
Absolutely.
Okay. We've established the cosmology, the nature of the self, and the final goals. Now let's get down to the brass tacks, the origin of the knowledge itself. How is truth actually acquired in these systems? This is part four. Epistemology and synthesis.
And the contrast here is fundamental. It defines the entire nature of the spiritual practice you'd undertake.
In Cannon's system, the method for acquiring knowledge is revelation.
Correct. Truth is transmitted from an external or higher source. It's channeled. That source is the subconscious or the higher self, which often speaks through the hypnotized client as a kind of conduit.
And that information often comes from who?
Often from what are described as extraterrestrial beings or councils of light or other discarnate entities. The point is, the subject is essentially a passive channel receiving information from an outside authority that possesses the complete cosmic perspective. It is knowledge delivered to you.
Now compare that to the Buddhist path, which is famously practice-oriented and even skeptical of blind faith or dogma.
The path is realization. It's active, not passive. You do not simply receive the truth. You must personally verify it through rigorous inner work.
The path itself is the method.
Yes. It requires cultivating ethical conduct, intense mental discipline through meditation, and the development of wisdom, or prajna. And prajna is the direct personal insight into the nature of reality as being impermanent and devoid of a separate self. The ultimate authority is not an external being. It is your own direct experience of reality achieved through your own efforts.
The Buddhist tradition is famous for the saying, you know, don't take the word of the Buddha himself.
Yeah.
You must go and practice and see for yourself.
Right. Whereas Cannon's tradition says the all-knowing source is telling us this truth through this channel, and this account aligns with thousands of other channeled accounts we've collected. The difference in the source of authority determines everything.
It determines the veracity of the claim for different types of people. Cannon's knowledge is based on this channeled information obtained through hypnotic regression, which by definition, is not empirically verifiable through standard scientific means.
Its value, therefore, is rooted in its internal consistency and its ability to cohere thousands of personal testimonies into a single massive, compelling narrative.
Okay, so given all these contradictions, the rejection of anatta, the huge emphasis on a permanent soul, the total reliance on revealed knowledge, how should we ultimately categorize Cannon's expansive body of work?
Our sources clearly categorize it not as a simple reinterpretation of Eastern philosophy, but as a form of syncretic New Age mythology.
Syncretic meaning it blends different systems.
Exactly. It's a synthesis that borrows Eastern ideas like karma and reincarnation, but it strips them of their impersonal and frankly arduous nature, and it blends them instead with distinctly Western esoteric concepts.
And the analysis in the sources draws a specific, very powerful link to Gnosticism. That's a heavy label. Why Gnosticism?
The structural parallels are striking. Classic Gnosticism, both the ancient forms and the modern revivals, shares three core structural elements with Cannon's system.
What's the first?
First, the absolute insistence on the eternal individual soul, which is seen as a divine spark that is trapped or imprisoned in a low-frequency material world. This, as we've established, is completely antithetical to Buddhist anatta, but is foundational to Gnosticism.
Okay, that's a clear link. And second?
Second, the origin story of reality. It often involves a distant, ultimate, unknowable creator.
The creator source.
Yes, often termed the monad in Gnosticism. But our material world, this dense reality, is often said to be created or governed by a lower, flawed entity, sometimes called a demiurge. Cannon's system often implies that the old Earth reality is managed by lower frequencies or lesser forces, which is why it requires this direct intervention from the ultimate source to fix it.
And crucially, the intermediaries. This is where the subconscious or the higher self comes in.
Exactly. The third and most defining link is the epistemology, how you get saved. In Gnosticism, salvation or liberation is achieved through secret knowledge, gnosis, which is revealed by extraterrestrial intermediaries or advanced beings.
Which, in Cannon's work, are the subconscious or the various channeled entities.
Precisely. This special knowledge reveals the individual's true divine, eternal nature and shows them the way to escape the lower realms. This fundamentally contrasts with Buddhist prajna, which is wisdom gained through personal, non-secret, verifiable insight into the nature of things.
So the mechanism of salvation in both Gnosticism and Cannon system relies on having the veil lifted for you by an external authoritative source of information.
Rather than achieving liberation through your own self-reliant, ethical, and meditative practice, it's a fundamentally separate spiritual operating system.
That feels like the ultimate conclusion. Cannon's work uses the vocabulary of Eastern tradition karma, reincarnation, but it operates from an entirely separate Gnostic-adjacent paradigm that is focused on revelation, cosmic identity, and the final ascent of the permanent soul.
It's a different path to a different destination.
Let's pull back then and evaluate the practical value of this mythology. Regardless of its philosophical rigor or its verifiability, what is the profound function this system serves for a contemporary audience? Why is it so popular?
I think the primary value lies in its unparalleled capacity to provide a compelling and immediate sense of meaning and purpose. It is a powerful antidote to the existential uncertainty and meaninglessness that plagues so much of the modern world.
It addresses the big three: identity, purpose, and cosmic structure.
Perfectly put. It provides three layers of very powerful reassurance. First, cosmic identity. You are not just a flawed human. You are a star person, a volunteer, an advanced soul who chose to take on a noble, difficult assignment. This immediately solves the problem of alienation.
Second, direct purpose.
Yes. Life is not random suffering. It is a meticulously planned mission or a contractual agreement you made to assist in a grand planetary transformation. Your life has meaning.
And third, reassurance.
The deepest reassurance of all. The universe is presented as a structured, benevolent, meticulously planned system that is overseen by advanced, loving beings like the subconscious. It's not a cold, indifferent cosmos. It's a managed, loving one.
That is the exact opposite of the radical self-reliance demanded by the Buddhist path, which basically says, the universe is indifferent. The only benevolence you're going to find is the compassion you cultivate yourself.
Precisely. Cannon's system resonates so deeply because it shifts the focus from your personal inadequacy to your cosmic importance. The knowledge claims are based on revelation, which makes them very difficult to verify, but their value as a cohesive, uplifting and internally consistent mythology is profound for those seeking order and purpose outside of traditional mainstream structures.
It tells you that you matter and that your struggle is actually evidence of your advanced nature.
A very powerful message.
Okay, so this deep dive has really presented two parallel realities. On one side, we have millennia of tradition rooted in radical personal effort, the dissolution of the ego, and the ultimate escape from form.
And on the other side, we have this modern mythology rooted in revelation, the elegition of the permanent soul, and the evolution of form to a higher state.
So let's synthesize. The takeaway is clear. Dolores Cannon was undeniably an investigator of reality who used modern methods hypnosis and this systematic cross-referencing of thousands of cases to verify the enduring spiritual architecture described in traditional Indian philosophy.
The reality of karma, the cycle of samsara, and the existence of the eternal soul, the Atman. She found modern evidence for the Hindu model.
But her truly transformative work, the work that defines her later career, was in reporting on a present-day cosmic moment. She was the chronicler of a planned, multidimensional plan for transcendence, for ascension.
And this plan offered a rapid, high-frequency path to liberation through things like karmic cancellation and these volunteer mission contracts. A path that stands in profound opposition to the long, slow, disciplined cycles required by historical Buddhist and Hindu paths.
Ultimately, the source material concludes that Cannon's system operates from a fundamentally separate, modern Gnostic paradigm.
It provides a powerful, comforting narrative of cosmic importance and benevolent design that caters directly to the spiritual needs and the psychological landscape of the 21st century.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to explore on your own. We've discussed two powerful, cohesive spiritual frameworks. One is rooted in millennia of philosophical rigor, demanding radical self-reliance and the extinguishing of the self for ultimate freedom. That's Nirvana.
And the other is rooted in modern channeled revelation, promising rapid evolution and a grand cosmic purpose for the permanent soul. That's ascension.
So the question is this. In your own search for truth and meaning, does the ultimate value of a spiritual framework lie in its verifiable rigor and the necessity of arduous personal effort?
Or does it lie in its powerful capacity to provide immediate meaning, a sense of identity, and a profound, benevolent cosmic reassurance?
Something to ponder as you reflect on the rules of the cosmos you believe you inhabit. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.